Okay. Okay, next we'll have Dublin up to read the history of this meeting.
Yay, Dublin.
Origin of the La Cañada Men's 7 O'Clock Let's Rock Al-Anon by Al-Anonic Pat, founding member. I'm not Pat, but I'm going to pretend I am just for a few minutes here. In the summer of 1991, my wife Candy and I decided to take our first vacation since she got sober in November 1989. We traveled toward the great Northwest and through 9 western states. Our first stop was in the town of Morro Bay, where we spent the night. Candy had seemed a little squirrely and asked if we might check out an AA meeting in the town. We did so and decided that for the rest of our trip, we would go to an AA or Al-Anon meeting in every state we visited. Upon returning to California some weeks later, we made our last stop in Palm Springs. We found an AA meeting and an Al-Anon meeting at the Betty Ford Treatment Center. I had talked to an Al-Anon member afterwards, and he asked me if I would like to attend his Al-Anon men's group the next night. I decided to decline since Candy and I were anxious to get home. On the drive back to La Cañada that night, I was complaining to Candy about my men's Al-Anon group. So Monday night meeting in San Marino that started at 8:30. It was approximately 20 miles from my house, and after the meeting, I usually didn't get home until around midnight. I had a 7 a.m. class to teach the next morning and resented the fact that I needed to get up at 5:30 a.m. to make that happen. So after ranting and raving for about 15 minutes, Candy had grown tired of listening to me and said, "Hey, why don't you quit your whining and start a men's Al-Anon meeting here in La Cañada and start it at 7 o'clock?" What a concept. The rest is history. We had our first meeting on Thursday, October 10, 1991, in Harris Hall, a small room in the back of the La Cañada Presbyterian Church. Who was there? Raise your hand. Stand. Oh, stand. You might as well stand. Who was there? Stand up. Please. Was it just you? Oh, okay. Well, congratulations. As I recall, there was about a dozen men or so at that meeting, at that first meeting, half of which came from the San Marino men's group to lend support for the first meeting. The only other man that attended that first meeting and is still an active member today was Willie W. Within a few months, Jack H., Ron R., and Jack C., this Jack C., right? Yeah. Joined our group and have all been instrumental in making our meeting the best damn men's Al-Anon group in the world. Yeah. It did say in the world, yeah. As a side note, some people have asked me how our meeting, 7 o'clock Let's Rock, got its name. Willie had returned from a World Service conference and reported that we needed to have a name for our group. He said, maybe we could call it the La Cañada Men's Kick-Ass Group. He was new to Al-Anon. After a brief discussion, we decided that Central Office probably would not let us print that in the meeting directory. One of my favorite songs back in the late 70s was Saturday Night's All Right for Fightin' by Elton John. Some of the lyrics contained in the first part of the song are, "It's 7 o'clock and I wanna rock, I wanna get a belly full of beer. My old man is drunker than a barrel full of monkeys and my old lady, she don't care." I thought to myself, wow, if this isn't a song about alcoholism, I don't know what is. Hence the name, 7 o'clock, let's rock.
That sounded good to me, kick ass. Well, you heard the history. It's been about 10 days ago, Pat had extensive back surgery, and it was very difficult for him. So what I thought we would do is everybody on the count of three just say, "Hello, Pat, we miss you, get well." And John is taping this, and I'll send it to him. I spoke to Candy just before we came to the meeting, and she said that he's doing better now. He's rehabbing. But it's been a rough road for him. It was pretty tough, so.
Repeat what you
want us to say. Okay, how can I remember that? I can't remember my name. Okay, here we go. Okay, here's what we're gonna do. Hello, Pat. We miss you.
We miss you.
Get well.
Get well.
And finally, we love you.
We love you.
Okay, we'll send that to him. Thanks. Thanks, John. Yeah, it's been my privilege to be a member of this group since the very beginning. Pat was just a great innovator. In fact, he started a men's group up there where he is in St. George, Utah. And but it doesn't equal 7 o'clock, let's rock. So any event, we missing. But I like to say that without the thought of he and his wife and the brilliant idea to start this meeting, many of us would never cross path. So we owe a great deal to number one, Alcoholics Anonymous, number two, Al-Anon, and number three, Pat and Candy, for having the foresight to start this meeting here. So I just want to thank them for that. Now, this is our first speaker night. And we've got two speakers here, and one of the most difficult things to do is speak before the people you kind of frequent a lot. And so, but when I asked these two speakers if they would speak for us tonight, as usual, he said, "I'm frightened, but I'm armored," because I taught him that. So our speakers tonight is going to be Jack and Leslie, the two people I just really, really, truly adore. And Leslie and Jack said that you would go first. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Leslie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leslie.
And I'm very grateful to be here tonight, and I think this is one of the greatest men's meetings there is around that I've ever been to. I'm privileged to be here tonight and with my wonderful husband. And it's been good because we've been coming here for a long time. And it's the first time I've had to share, so I'm going to tell you what it was really like. Because you've heard him tell me about me all the time, you know. And so I get to have the upper hand now. And we have a fabulous life, you know. I just took 30 years of sobriety, and the man that's when I came to AA, the only thing I didn't want to do was just not drink. And you know, today is I just don't want to drink. Because I don't ever want to go back to that person I was when I first came in here. You know, and I was a mean, nasty bitch. That is my main personality, I got to tell you that. Nobody can believe that. I know it's hard, but that person is in there somewhere. you know, and I try to keep her way down by doing all these stupid little things you have to do, make a phone call to your sponsor and do the steps and do these simple things, you know, but they aren't simple at all, because when I first came down on, or AA, I knew if I got rid of him, my problems would be solved. You know, my sponsor said, Leslie, you know, in your first year, we don't make any major decision for you. It's 3 because you're really sick. And I even had her over to dinner so we could talk about him in the kitchen afterwards, so she could tell me how much she didn't like him. But she said I had to stick with him. And I didn't think that was fair, but oh well. You know, I followed direction. And, you know, thank God I didn't, because if I would have done it in my first 3 years, we wouldn't be here today, you know. And I loosened, and I just did what I was told. And we're told to take a lot of commitments. And now it's really hard to get people to take commitments. And we didn't get to say no. It was just, you're doing it. And I like that. You know, I needed direction. I had people love me my entire life. And if it were about love, I would have been really great. My parents loved me so much, you know. And love isn't enough for the disease of alcoholism, I gotta tell you. It's a deadly disease, and it kills our families all over the world. And it's not just here and there, it's months, you know. It's bad. And it kills generation after generation after generation, it has done. And you know, I finally was able to put a stop in mine, because it didn't have to continue. Jack's family, however, has continued to drink, and I admire them. I love their pictures. They got the pitcher of beer, and they get, you know, sometimes it looks really good. But, you know, I don't ever want to go back there. And I thought not too long ago, I was thinking, you know, I would just like a drink just to just not feel for a few seconds. You know, but I know it would last more than a few seconds. It would last, I don't think I could do it again. I wouldn't be as stupid to do all the stupid things I had to do when I first came here. You know, I'm a lot smarter, and I know the hardest thing for an alcoholic when they go out and drink again is to come back. And there's nobody greater that wants to get sober as that one that keeps putting up their hand week after week after week after week, because they have the knowledge, and it says knowledge avails us nothing. And what it does, it keeps us from being able to get sober again, you know, and I don't want to ever test the waters. I know what I have, and it's a deadly disease. I have a lot of deadly disease, and none of them has gotten me yet, so God isn't done. He just keeps, you know, insisting I am here, and I just keep showing up, and that's amazing to me, you know. And I thought Jack needed a program after I got sober. I took him to a lot of AA meetings, and we kept saying he needed a lot of help. And so he got down on, and then, you know, he went out to coffee after Al-Anon, and I went out to coffee after AA meetings, but he was going with women. I was going with women. I didn't think that was quite fair. You know, I didn't like that then. And I had to share my opinions about it, and then I had to just let it go. And I sure wish I knew about letting go, because, you know, when you're going through something, I think, how did that happen? How do I remember it? And then I look at all these books that I've carried around with me since I've been really young, and they're all about letting go, you know, let God. I thought, I should have read those books. I carried them with me. I never read them, you know. And that's kind of how I've always done life, you know. And when I got along with Jack, I never met anybody that didn't drink. I didn't ever go with anybody that didn't drink. They weren't fun. And I found out he was just crazy. He'd been around too many of us. And, you know, and we had a lot of fights. And he could never figure out how I got so drunk after just one drink. And he, poor guy, had never seen me sober when he met me. So he had nothing to compare it to. And he just thought I was exciting sometimes, but sometimes I became mean. You know, you just never knew when that person was going to be. And I certainly wasn't consistent, you know. And my dad, he didn't want to tell anybody I was in AA until he came to an AA meeting and heard somebody speak, and they got up and told their story, and they told it from, and it was somebody his age, and so open and honest. And my dad couldn't put enough money in the basket, and he was a promoter of AA. My husband's family did not think that was so great. He'd say, "Go, just you feel better," you know. And it took our son quite a while to get sober, and he said, "You know, one of the things is he wondered what we had." You know, but it was really, really hard for him. You know, because I asked God for a change in my first year, and I didn't listen to my sponsor. She said, "The big book tells you how to pray. Keep to it, and it'll be okay." Well, you know, I asked for a change in my life, and I got two teenagers. That is not what I wanted. Now, I've done teenagers quite a few times, and I'm not doing it again. We're slowly getting past that stage. And, you know, and I had a best friend, and she used to call me every morning and say, "Good morning, Leslie," you know, and she'd know instantly how I was. And I got to share her life with her and her drinking, and there was a place in California you could go that she didn't know a bar. And I was impressed with that. I'm glad I did not get drink in California that much at the end. Because I knew I had to drink at home because I couldn't go out, because if I go out, I go to bed with people I'm not planning on being with. And I'm sure they're not planning on being with me either, you know. They weren't always thrilled, and, you know, but when you pass out, you're kind of out of luck when you don't know where the person lives. And that was kind of how Jack met me. So he took me home to live with him and his wife. And I kind of liked it there afterwards. We kind of had mom and dad, sister, brother. We had fun, you know. And she was telling me about how problems in her marriage, and I tried to help fix them, but Jack told me to keep my mouth shut. And so I got crushed in a car, so he started taking care of me. And thank God, I owed that woman a great deal of debt, you know, because when I got sober, my sponsor says, "You know, you're going to have to make amends." Well, it took me 5 years to finally make that amends. Now, if you would have told me if I would have made that amends, you know, sooner, I would get trust in my marriage. I would get all those gifts that you don't know you're going to get. And, you know, never downside me. We have a lot of trust, you know. And that's one of the greatest gifts. I used to think it was money, property, and prestige. I always wanted to have the picket fence on the hill and the mountain. But, you know, God keeps me right in somewhere low in the mountains, just sit there, you know. We're going to stay here for the rest of our lives. That's what we've just sat in. You know, it's the same house that Jack and his ex-wife lived in. And it's a little bit different now, though. It has a lot of warmth, and it's a lot different. And it took us, you know, we did the backwards way. We started with sex, and we didn't know how to have a friendship, and it took a long time to figure that one out, you know, how to be friends. And we just knew how to be really mad at each other. And I would know by the time, way he got up and how he looked at me, as if I were in trouble. I was always in trouble. And one day, I got smart. And I said, "You know, if you're this mad in the morning, I haven't been up long enough to make you mad, so I'm going back to bed." And he stood there just mad as anything, and then he can dream about anybody. And I thought, I like this deal. You know? And then when they get out, Al-Anon Works book came out, and I was reading, I said, "You know, I think I'm just an Al-Anon." Jack says, "Let's look at your drinking history." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's just part of it, you know." But, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so, so grateful. I have loved it since the time I came in. I don't ever, ever want to walk away from it. And it's easy. You stay home from a meeting one time, the second time you miss it, and then the third time you think, "I hate all those people. Why am I even going?" You know, that's my head. It just goes. It just tells me that, you know, it tells me things that aren't true. And Jack said one time, and then he said, "And you believe what you're saying?" I said, "Well, not always." And sometimes I have to tell Jack, you know, he says, "I told you," and I said, "I know, but this time I'm going to listen." I said, I heard what you said, I saw your mouth moving, but I did not hear what you really said. You know, so we have a lot of those conversations. I go from one room, then I get to the next room, and I forget. I get busy, shiny thing, take off, you know. Some things never change, you know, and we have a lot of love in our life, you know. I have grandkids, and we had a grandson come out one summer, and we had a lot of fun. He was hibernated, and he didn't know how to be around people, and we opened his eyes. He changed completely after he was with us. And, you know, he's a great young gentleman and in service and supporting our troops, you know. That's one of the greatest things. And our son's sober, and his wife drinks. I think she has a little bit of a drinking problem. That's just my opinion, though. And so they have done several geographics. And I know about geographics because I did a lot of them before coming out to California. Once I got out here, I thought, I am meant to be in California. I never liked the snow. I grew up in the middle of, in Omaha, Nebraska, and one of the greatest places to grow up. I wish my kids could have grown up there because it was wonderful. It's like Leave It to Beaver, you know? And my parents loved me, and, you know, if they could have fixed it, they would have, but they didn't know how to do that, you know? And my mom comes to visit, and my husband and I, it's the only family we have left of a parent, and we're both very, very lucky. She comes out quite a few times and stays with us for a while, and she was a big help. And, you know, Jack and I, you know, it took me about 10 years to get, when I was sober, to get really angry, because, you know, I was afraid to get angry. Because I promised myself when I tried to stab my brother when I was 9 that I would never let that rage get out again. And they buried it so deep it took a long time. Father Tom said one time, he says, you know, sometimes it takes the women a lot longer to get angry, and then they get angry, and then it's hard to get out of that anger. And I always think Jack's a problem. You know? And then it says somewhere in that, how it works, it says, I'm the problem. I don't like that. You know, but thank God, because if I know I'm the problem, there's a solution. If I am not part of the problem, then there is no solution. And sometime my heart gets ripped out. My best friend that I was telling you about, she passed away in our home. I got to bring her home towards the end, and we had hospice care, and we sat by her side, and AA and Al-Anon came in, and it was the greatest gift she ever gave me. Not only did she share her life and her stories, but she shared her gift of how much she trusted me. Because those are the gifts that are given to me, is trust, love, acceptance, all those things that I didn't know were gifts. You know, when I sponsor women, I say, you know, they learn they can trust me. And that's a great gift. I love sponsoring newcomers. I love seeing how they change and they start becoming, you know, regular attendees and start dressing up and feeling good about themselves. You know, my sponsor told me, Leslie, if you can't dress up for yourself, dress up for Alcoholics Anonymous. At least look good, you know. She said, you can at least be an attraction because nobody wants what you have. I thought that's so true, you know. Got to teach two things, attraction and be sober, and that the rest doesn't matter. You know, as long as I stay sober today, I'm a success. She told me that the first day I got sober. She says, Leslie, if you don't drink today, you're successful. And I haven't been successful at anything. And, you know, for to have that, I thought, this is great. And Jack wasn't impressed with it at all, and I just stay sober, you know. But I thought it was impressive. And he would say, are you getting up to go to that meeting? I'd say, nope. I'm going to stay under the covers until it's time. And then I go to a meeting, get dressed up. And he'd see me come home and be happy. And then pretty soon he comes by and we growl at each other, you know. And we learned how to do time. And many times in our marriage, even when it's been good, we've learned how to do time. Because there are things come up that there isn't a left love that can make things okay, you know. And I sponsored this one woman. How much time? 2 minutes?
Oh, you got plenty.
Okay. I sponsored this one woman. She came in and out, and she'd get drunk, she'd get sober, she'd get drunk, she'd get sober. And every time she got sober, she had a kid. Surprising how that happens, you know? God knew to not have that happen to me. I had trouble keeping care of myself, you know? And, you know, she died about 6 years ago of the disease of alcoholism, with everybody hating her. And it's the saddest thing, but the greatest gift she gave me was two of her daughters. And we became parents, and it'll be this month that, you know, it was our anniversary. That my daughter, my youngest daughter, sitting here in front, you know, and what a gift. She's taught me how to be a strong woman in AA. She taught me how to be a strong woman and fight for what they need. And she taught me that I could stand up to the board of LA Unified and not be afraid. And many times Jack would be gone because he had to go work. Somebody has to work, obviously. I didn't. And I got to raise these two beautiful little girls with him. And they have a brother. And Mia just used to love him. And he told my daughter, said, you don't ever want to leave. They change the locks on you. My oldest found out that she tried it his way. It didn't work very well. She returned. Mia's going to stay with me forever. I'm so glad. You know. And she gives me her heart. And they both give me their heart. And they say, trust, you know, don't hurt me, you know. They just want to be loved. Like all of us want to just be loved. We want to be accepted exactly for who we are. And I have learned to do that for myself. You know, and everything's a rescue in our house. The dogs are rescues, you know, and they come strolling in and people come in. And, you know, it's just, it's always amazing to me, you know. And everybody becomes family, you know. My cousin came one time to spend the summer and she goes, she didn't hug anybody. And as everybody came in and they would give her hugs and she goes, I get it. You gave everybody hugs. Jack said, except the UPS guy. And she was agoraphobic, and by the time she left her house, she got involved in Alateen. She went home, and she was just on fire with Alateen. And then she tried her drinking, and she would call me, and she'd say, I know what you're going to say already. She says, why do you think I waited so long to call, you know? And she was there the year my one friend passed away at her home, and then a year later she got to be with her mom and her grandmother and help her mom when her grandmother passed away and got to be there with hospice because she already learned how to do the deal, you know? And now she's a mom and she has a 2-year-old little boy and he's just a doll and she's just a doll. And we took her on trips and then we've had this one girl I sponsor, we took her on a trip after taught her how that she could have fun in AA and take trips because she only had one leg. You know, her good idea was when she got drunk, she got a gun and she wanted to feel what it was going to feel like before she shot herself in the head. And she said, you never know how bad you want to live until you're almost dying. And she said, I know if I get drunk again, I'll probably blow the other leg off. Yeah. And she still calls me. She's back in Texas now. And she says, I already can hear what you're having to say. You know, I hear your voice all of the time. You know, because those voices stay with us that we get to hear, you know. She always calls at the right time, you know. And she was watching Mia when Mia was little. And she says, I can hit you with this stick. Your mom said I could. And she was fascinated. And we took her and Jack taught her how to swim, and we've just gotten to do a lot of things with a lot of people and show them how to live, because that's what we learn how to do here, is learn how to live. And so many of us don't know how. I certainly didn't know how to live. You know, and I believed that I had to drink all I could until I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I wouldn't have drank, I don't think I would have made it this long, wanting to get to the doors. And they told me I wouldn't live to be 30, and I thought, thank God. Now I'm 30 years older and past 30, and I never thought I'd be this old. You know, you put everything and it comes all up, and then you take off all your clothes, and it all falls, and I think I'm an old lady. What happened? I got to tell you, that's really disappointing when that stuff happens. So the next day I could do it again, put it all up and hold it all up until I have to put it all down. Those are like the ups and downs of AA, you know, now and on, you know. And it took about 9 years for my mom to decide she needed Al-Anon, but Zetz picked her up and she says, "You need Al-Anon, honey." And, you know, and when I went home one time, we went to my dad followed us in, we went slow and we showed up. And Peg Martin gave me her card. She said, "If you're ever in town, honey, give me a call." And 2 weeks later, I called and told her my dad's just passed away and I'm coming home. And she said, "Baby, I'm going to be right here." And she said, "Somebody will be picking you up." And somebody picked me up and took me to meetings. And I got to be there about for my mom. It wasn't about my dad. It wasn't about me. It was about my mom, Liz, and her best friend. Because they've been married for 45 years, been together her whole life. You know? And Jack and I are going to be married, I don't know, 28 or 29 years. Like 28.
Good call.
I finally remember that we got married in 1990. It took me a long time to figure that one out. It's always good. I'm not really good with math. Who cares? You don't need to know how to count sometimes. You just need to know how to show up. And, you know, life is grand. I have a best friend. We have learned to have true intimacy. We turn off our phones, which is an amazing thing to do when you find out after a while, because everybody's sitting there talking. I was outside at dinner one night, and everybody had their phone conversation, and they weren't talking to anybody at their table. And I have learned to keep that thing and just shut it off, and so we take baths together, and we sit and we talk about nothing, just that intimacy that we get to have for a few minutes, to know that we can be a good foundation for our daughters. They don't always like us. It's okay. You know, they don't have to. Just like sponsees don't always have to like you, because sometimes they really get mad. God, you wouldn't believe you get fired more easy. I thought I never got hired. I didn't get fired and I didn't get paid. This is a bad job to have. And you know that, but you know, I just keep showing up and have new people put in my life, and we've had so many people put in our lives. And life hasn't been easy, and I get bad news all the time. My neurologist said one time, he says, "Mrs. Carpenter," he says, "you and your husband remind me of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid when they're on that bicycle going, raindrops keep falling on our head, but we keep going, you know?" And that's what we do, no matter what, good, bad, or indifferent, we show up. I get to show people about how you show up, no matter bad or good or anything else, we show up. And we get to show up for other people, and they show up when it's bad. And that's how we show each other. And sometimes it doesn't have to be any words, we just give each other a great big hug. And that, I found, fixes everything. I didn't used to think so, but that fixes everything. I don't need money, power, and prestige. A little money would be great, but I don't think God ever wants me to be rich. He doesn't want to find out like what I'd really be like. I know how it would be, you know. And my doctor always calls me with bad news. She called me today. I said, "Shit, I already thought you called me. I'd already made plans." And she just doesn't know how I do it, you know. And I don't either. I have a God that I don't understand. He's so large, and he just does amazing things. And I got this damn machine. I got to talk about it for 5 seconds. I got a CPAP machine. I hate it, hate it, hate it. Jack said I shouldn't say that, but I do. And I tell him how he like to be connected to a hose. He should try that sometime. Yeah, short range hose too, let me tell you. And but I actually, it does amazing things. You know, when you actually get sound sleep, your brain can think, which I never knew, you know. It was shut off half the time, half my life, it was always shut off, you know. And so I got this thing, and it makes life interesting. And I take it off in the middle of the night, and Jack says, "Put that back on." back.
I take direction when I'm asleep.
It's the only time I take direction, I want you to know.
And I don't know what I'd do with Adam. He is a man of my dreams. I didn't know how to have dreams. I didn't know how to have man's dreams. And you know, we have a lot to look forward to, a lot more adventures to go, I gotta tell you. I have a lot more planned. He doesn't know that yet. I was surprised because this last time I told him, I said, honey, I'm gonna be 30 and I know exactly what you can get because the trip is taking off on the day of my sobriety birthday and that means God wants me to take this trip. And you know, he made that happen. I was just amazed. I told him, God, I knew God would make sure it happens. You know, you just have to go to work. Don't worry about the rest. And he's been working. And, you know, life is but a dream. You know, and without all you in it, and I know most of you, you know, coming through this, is without all of you coming into our home and bringing that love, I don't know what life would be like. You know, but without that, you know, I get to share my best friend. I'll let you hear from him. But you heard the best half. I just make it exciting for him. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Just thank you, and thank you. The next speaker, you know, her hubby, the other half, I've known him since he's been in the rooms, and sometime I got the gift of, you know, taking this phone call for the last, I don't know, what, 18, 19 years, I mean. So it's been really good, and they are real family. I got to participate. When you talk about family, I got to participate in the family life. I was there when they got the girls. I was there when she graduated from high school and got the second in her class. So we get to do that as family around here. So without any further ado, this guy, like I said, he talks all over the world. And it's true, he said to me, the most difficult thing to do is talk before the people you get to hang with every week. So without any further ado, I introduce Jack C.
That was my two best friends in the world right there. My name's Jack. I'm a grateful, enthusiastic, and I am still, after all these years, a very active member of the Al-Anon family groups. I stay right in the middle of you. I've been doing it a long time. We talked about the history of this group. 1991, Pat started the meeting in October. 4 months later, we went to San Fernando Valley Convention. We just got tickets to a table. You're going to sit with whoever you sit with. We wind up sitting with Pat and Candy. I'd never met them before. And they caught my attention because we were what was recognized as a backwards couple in Al-Anon AA. I'm supposed to be the drunk, she's supposed to be the long-suffering Al-Anon. Matter of fact, when we would go to conventions, they would see us walking. I knew what they were thinking. They were thinking, oh, what that woman must have put up with when that guy was drinking. I had a resentment right away from all of that. So here sits Pat and Candy, and she's the alcoholic and he's the Al-Anon. And we started talking. He says, you know, I just started this men's meeting up in Lockheed United. Why don't you come up and try it? So I called my sponsor and I said, they got this new men's group going on in Lockheed United. I'm doing fine in the meeting with the women. It doesn't bother me to be in the meeting with the women. It's never been a problem for me. I went up and came to the meeting the first night. It was speaker night. And there, I walked in my first men's stag and there were women there. I called my sponsor to report you. Well, let women in up there. They said, well, there's speaker night. On speaker night, we let women come to the meeting. I said, all right, well, next week I'm coming. It's going to be the men's stack. There was about eight of us by then because the Monrovia group, whatever it was, had stopped coming. Now we're down about eight guys. On speaker night, we'd get, woohoo, 12 to 14 people. And we weren't doing very well on our own, by the way. So my first night in the little room over here in a building that they had to knock down after we got done with it, we sat in our little group. 7 o'clock came, we start on time. At that precise moment, a woman came to the door and she leaned in and she said, pardon me, but is this an Al-Anon meeting? Now, I've been watching her go to AA and go to women's stag meetings in AA, and I know what would happen if I showed up there. You'd find my hide tanning on the door in the morning. It'd just skin you and leave you hang up there. I really thought that Pat was going to walk over there and say to this woman, "I'm sorry, honey, this is a men's stag meeting, and you have to go away." I was prepared to have him say that. What Pat said was, "Yes, ma'am, this is an Al-Anon meeting, but according to the fifth tradition, we are an Al-Anon meeting first. If you're here for a meeting, you're welcome to stay. Please feel free to join us." That woman came in and sat with us, and it was the only meeting she came to. And over the years, before we moved into the fishbowl here, where women who come on men's night accidentally would come in, and we'd just get them a cup of coffee and sit them down. And I've heard them report back over the years about what happened as a result of what they heard going on in this room with these guys. Now they come and they look in that door and go, "Ah!" and they run for the hills. I have no idea how many of them there are. But over the years, maybe 200 women came and did that. 1991, Pat starts a meeting. 1992, I think it was the first meeting in March, because I met him in February at the San Fernando Convention. Maybe it was the first meeting in February. It was late January. They had that convention. And I came to that meeting. And we didn't do very well left our own devices. I did fine in the women's meeting, in the mixed meetings. You know, we hug each other. There's real intimacy going on. We're eight guys trying to figure this out, and we just don't really know. So there wasn't a lot of hugging, a lot of tears, a lot of stuff. It was a lot of this. Because, and I've heard this 100 times in this room when guys come in new. The same feeling I had when I came in here new is that all of us were there looking for who might be a potential adversary. Who am I going to have to fight? Who am I going to have to watch? Who was a threat to me, physical or otherwise? That was how we looked and treated each other in that early days, because we did not know any better. And we've had countless men come into this room, and when they finally get up the courage to share in a group where we've got 80 to 100 guys at a men's stag Al-Anon meeting, and they tell us that that was their feeling, it was the same one that we all had. That same year that I came, that February or March when I came to the first meeting here, that November my dad died. And I brought what it was really like right to you guys, right to this room, right to my support system, right to my family, and said, "This is what it's like. This is how much it hurts." And soon after me, Lee lost his dad. It wasn't long after that. Lee spoke about that the other day at a meeting. And the level of intimacy and trust and bond in the meeting began to change. And people will tell you now that when you come in here, this is one of the most loving, engaged group of men they have ever seen. And in those days when women would actually come to the group and they would hear men sharing on the level that we share here, telling the real deal about what it feels like, and they have never, in their experience, especially coming from an alcoholic home, have never experienced that from men in their entire life. We had one woman come back every week for about 2 months. Somebody asked her about the third week, "Why do you keep coming back now you know it's a men's meeting?" She said, "Man, I'm not seeing out there what I'm seeing in here. I'll sit right here in the back, but I'm coming every week." And she did. She came for a couple of months and then went and found another meeting. My story is that today I was at work. I got up at 2 o'clock this morning to go to work. I'm going to do it again tomorrow. And we do long days doing what I'm doing. And I sat down to have a sandwich about 11 o'clock with my boss and with the producer on the show that we're with. And we got to talking about current events. And the topic sort of came up, and this is not really an outside issue because it's just about us. What would it be like for us if we were in a confirmation hearing? And I'll tell you what it would be like for me. So, Mr. Carpenter, is it true that in 1977, you got a phone call in the middle of the night and you raced out to a bar where your brother had been in a gang fight, him against eight guys, to go rescue him, and on that night you attempted to run down eight young men with your car? Yes, I'm afraid that's true, sir. Is it true that in 1986 you were on the way to a date with your girlfriend when she was in a terrible car wreck in which she died and went straight to the hospital and died again, that on that night you decided when they threw her out of the hospital it'd be a good idea to bring that woman home to live with you and your wife? Isn't that true, Mr. Carpenter? I said, yes, it is. About that time the producer decided he's never hiring me on another one of his movies. Because they don't understand that stuff at the Kiwanis Club and the PTA. But you know, here we just laugh at it and go, "Oh yeah, me too, did that. No problem." I grew up in a family that's shot through with alcoholism in every direction. I have no idea what it is. Confronted with her at the end of her drinking, we were together for the last year and a half, her active drinking under the roof of the house we live in now. She came to me and she told me she thought she was an alcoholic. and that she needed to quit, but she didn't think she could do it on her own. She would need to get some help. And what I apparently said to her, and I don't recall, is I said, if you go get help that's anybody but me, you're out. That's the level of arrogance that I was going to bring to you and that I brought to my relationship, to my closest relationships. Against my wishes, she did go and get some help to get sober. And she just told you on her 30th anniversary, we went up the gangway of a ship to go cruise the Greek Isles to celebrate 30 years of sobriety in AA. And apparently I had nothing to do with her getting sober. I thought I did. See, what happens when they're drinking is you're head on points, right? Remember the point system? Oh, I missed the point system. You got control of everything. If she was still drinking, I wouldn't be here. I was fine when she drank. She was in trouble every day. I wake up spring-loaded in a pissed-off position every single day. When you got a blackout alcoholic, they wake up thinking they must have done something wrong, and they're sorry. You know what happens then? You get anything you want. Yeah, that's right. You know what I'm talking about. You got the checkbook. You got all the sex you want, all the home cooking you want. You got the TV clicker. That one's the hardest one to give up. It was a couple of years when I came to you guys before I gave up that clicker. I mean, I'd been selecting her view and pleasure while she drooled on the couch every night, passed out for a long time. Why am I interested in what you want to look at now that you're sober? She had a rule when we got together. She said, nobody gets out of bed in the morning until we've had sex. I'd been in a marriage that had been kind of cool in that area, and I wasn't anxious to jump into another relationship, but I thought, this is a good rule. What I know now because of what she shares with me and with you, and what she shares everything with you, I have no secrets in the world, and going to meetings is that because she was a blackout drinker, in her mind she believed that if I would have sex with her in the morning, no matter what happened last night, I was over it, or I'd soon get over it. And it was a survival tool for her and the disease. So now, I'm doing fine. I'm ahead on points every day. I got control of everything. God help us. I just feel warm and fuzzy all over thinking about it. And then she ruined my life. Yeah, she went to AA and got sober and just screwed everything up. Now, I just described to you what I got. I got an everyday blackout alcoholic. She's gorgeous then and now. There's no little old lady in these clothes. I watch her get undressed every night. I can't look away. I'm sorry, it doesn't happen. I'm hopelessly in love with her and think she's the most beautiful creature on the face of the earth. And off to AA goes this perfectly good blackout, hope to die, alcoholic woman, nymphomaniac. You know what they sent back? A sober lesbian. She comes back new sober, and first thing she says to me, she says, you know, I just realized I've never actually had sex with a man when I wasn't more or less insanely drunk. I'm not even sure I like men. You just keep that thing away from me. Oh, thank you, AA. Not your best work here, AA. Not a big fan. So I don't forget, I will tell you that she's no longer a lesbian, that I have the power to cure lesbians, but I've only used it one time. Yeah, I know. You guys have a rich fantasy life. So that family was full of alcoholics. It was actually a great sadness in my life that, you know, I couldn't wait to be old enough to do what they did. My parents were not alcoholic. That was confusing for a while. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters, later my own children, alcoholism throughout. Confronted with her alcoholism, I've got no idea what it is. I've been so thoroughly immersed in alcoholism that I've got no idea how to differentiate what she's got between what is just normal in my life in every direction. After she got sober and began dragging me to meetings, I became a really dangerous untreated Al-Anon. Because my family has been a mess. People have been dying and getting hurt and paying terrible prices for what's going on, and they're looking for something to fix it, but nobody knows what the problem is. I go with her to AA, and I identify the problem that's been tearing up my family for generations and in every direction. And then I decided it would be a great idea to go carry the message to them. They were thoroughly ungrateful and mostly unreceptive. I remember her and I presented one of my brothers an autographed big book of the Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe he used it as a coaster after that. my baby sister years after she was sober, and my family kind of got over being afraid to drink around us. They went right back to doing what they do because they're all still drinking. We went up for one holiday, and my baby sister, beautiful baby sister, shows up with her Christmas gift. It's a slung low on the hip, tied down holster, beer holster, right there. Seems she was having a problem with putting them down, picking them up, and then getting a mouthful of cigarette butts and stuff. She got tired of that, so she just strapped it on her, and it's right there when she needed it. I thought, I love alcoholics. They're so amazingly creative. She thought it was so bitching, she had two, one on each hip. Quick draw beer holster. Today, I'm entertained by that. I admire their creativity, and I'm a spectator, not a participant in the lives of those people. What I'll tell you is that after we'd been in recovery for a little while, right after my dad died, as a matter of fact, one of my brothers called me up, and he was in that place where I expected to get a bad phone call about him for quite a while. He was really in a dark spot. He was very close with my dad. And by then, it had been a long time since we'd done any 12-step work trying to help my family, uninvited, by the way. And he called me and he said, "Are you still going to those AA meetings?" And I said, "Yeah, we're going." He says, "We're going tonight." He said, "Can I come with you?" I was about fell out of my chair. I said, "Absolutely. Be here at this time. We'll go to the meeting." Took him to from that time to this, I was a regular attendee at an open AA speaker meeting as a non-alcoholic guest of AA, to learn about a disease I don't have and the people that have it. I took him to a meeting to hear a really funny, charismatic AA speaker. And he laughed. We went to coffee. He says, "Yeah, I'll go to coffee." He went to coffee. Went out and had pie. I had coffee. We're sitting in a restaurant having a cup of coffee and a piece of pie. And he looks across at me and he says, "Do you know why I wanted to go to AA?" And honest to God, I said, I have no idea. And he said, "Because I want what you have." And the lesson there that I learned, and it took a while with you guys, is that the people that are close to me, my wife for starters, my children, my brothers and sisters, that of all the people in the world that I might be able to have the power to help with my experience, strength, and hope, they're on the list, the ones I can't do that because they're too close. They will never, ever, ever, ever catch recovery from me through their ears, not in 10,000 years. But there's always just a chance, if you're doing this deal and you look like you're living this deal, that somebody might get some of it through their eyes, and that's what happened to him. He went to only one AA meeting, and he left. It had nothing to do with us, had nothing to do with what he heard. He just decided it wasn't for him, and he's still kind of out there doing what he does. My whole family is. Hanging out with this group, and you know, I'm going with her to AA. And we went to a Saturday night meeting. We went for a year and a half. We went out to Simi Valley to an AA meeting out there. And then we started going to a group called Back to Basics in the Valley. I was an Al-Anon with a commitment at the AA meeting. I was the Al-Anon contact. At every single meeting, they had me stand up and introduce myself. More people in that AA meeting, there's 200 people there every week, knew me than knew my wife. They would come to me and say, "Look, I'm looking for a meeting for my wife, or how do I get my sister to go to Al-Anon or whatever," and I became a contact doing 12-step work in AA, and I love those people. I love the way they did it. And they would go to coffee. They would go to Caro's after the meeting. And Caro's kept a room that was as big as from here to that wall square in the back just for us. They kept extra wait staff on the clock on Saturday nights because we were going to come in with probably 70 or 80 people from that AA meeting and have some pie and coffee and stuff after the meeting. That room was always there, and I would hear the message of recovery from the podium, but the deal was going on at coffee, man. They'd grab a newcomer and say, "Come with us to coffee," and I'd watch them working over a newcomer. They get the long, skinny booth. My wife and her girls were really good at this. They'd invite some new woman to coffee. A really good night, she was still drinking. She was still drunk. Oh, they just love that. Their eyes glow over like rats in a vampire movie. "Oh, there's a red one. Come on." I said, "Well, they're gone." They dragged this poor woman over to the corner booth, and it's a long booth, and they would just stand there and wait till she sat down. Then they'd all scooch in and squash her in the corner. Yeah. And then they'd completely ignore her and talk about their drinking. It just was, oh, I can't do AA 12-step work, but God, I love watching it happen. So I started coming to Al-Anon. I finally, after she had a year and a half of sobriety, I snuck out to go to a meeting. And I go to meetings, say, "Anybody going to coffee afterwards?" "No, going home." Out the door they go. Oh, unacceptable. I needed that coffee thing. When you're a newcomer, who can't share in the meeting, like I couldn't share in the meeting. I know you find it hard to believe now. I couldn't share. My sponsor would give me the elbow and I'd go, "I'm Jack, I'm glad to be here." And I'd sit back down. It was the best I could do for the first year in Al-Anon. And coffee was important to me because you could talk to somebody one-on-one. You could ask what would be what you're sure is a stupid question in the meeting. Not really, but you're sure that it is. And get an answer from four or five guys sitting across from coffee. So I come to this group and they got a meeting, 7, 8, 8:30, gone. Out they went. There's a restaurant right across the street. Are you guys paying attention? Willie was one of the first ones. I accosted him. I said, "We need to go to coffee." Sometimes it was me and Willie and Andy would go to coffee and drag him kicking and screaming over to coffee. And we began to build a relationship that you've heard where it went to as a result of that. And I work in a business where I'd go away on location for a while and I'd come back after a couple weeks. "How was coffee?" "Oh, we didn't go." I'd drag him kicking and screaming across the street to coffee. Eventually, they began to go and they went in bigger numbers. And across the street, it was Conrad's restaurant. It's not there anymore. Some heads nod and Lee and some other people. We would have like 50, 60 guys sitting in the back of the restaurant every week. And then we got a resentment because our milkshake machine broke and we moved to Hill Street. We've been there ever since. And coffee happens whether I go or not. But when you're new, man, when somebody says, "Why don't you join us?" You know what that means to somebody who comes from where we come from and houses where we're not heard or seen, or when we are, there's consequences involved in that, and off we drag them to coffee. We even drugged a lot of those women who came by accident to this meeting, drug them off to coffee. So I'm looking around to do, I need to do the work here. I don't know what to do, I need to do the steps. At the time, it was before I got to this group, I'm looking around for a sponsor, and there was like one guy kind of came and went. I figured he's supposed to be a guy sponsoring me, so I asked him and he said, "Yeah." And he'd never done the steps, he had no idea, and I knew I needed to do the work. I went to a meeting one night, a speaker meeting. I love speaker meetings because when you're new, you don't have to say anything. And the lady talked for the entire hour about changing sponsors. That there are times in her life where something happened with her. She had a new area or a different direction she needed to recover in. She would change sponsors. And as a sponsor, she says, "I've had women that I sponsor come to me and say, I had to get another sponsor." And she's excited for them that they've grown enough with her to see a new area in their life, or they go do the work, and instead of being insulted or offended by being fired as a sponsor, which by the way is what I'm trying to do here my whole life, is to attain humility because I know that's where the solution is, she treated it as a compliment, said, "Go with God, come back if you ever want. I'm always here, I'll always take your phone calls." On that night, I approached a woman in Al-Anon. I asked her if she would sponsor me. And her answer is the proper answer to the question, "Will you sponsor me?" There is only one. It isn't, "I'll get back to you, need to check with my sponsor, I haven't done the steps, I'm sponsoring too many people." The proper answer to that question was, "I'd be honored to work with you." That was what she said to me. Thank God she did, because I had no other options than I'd have left. And she got me busy doing the work. And by the time we got around the inventory process, this has nothing to do with Al-Anon literature. Her experience was in the AA Big Book. She put us together, sat down with that book. We did the inventory from the book and worked out of the book from that point on, because it's what she knew. She was not an AA. Her sponsor had done that with her, and I've been doing that with a lot of people for a long time and really reached in here and changed every piece of me. One of the things I didn't tell you about is that in my early life and prior to meeting Leslie, there was a tragedy involving one of my children. In 1977, I'd just come home out of the Marine Corps right towards the end of Vietnam. I was very lucky not to go see combat. My older brother, not so much. He did two tours. He's mostly homeless and missing since then. He just turned up, I think, in Missouri. We're not sure. And he came back, I think he came back a mess, an alcoholic, drug addict, drug addicted mess. And my little girl, I'm beginning a career in the movie business, trying to make my bones. My then wife was working at a hardware store to pay the rent on a nasty little flat top house down in San Fernando. And the babysitter wasn't watching our kids and my daughter drowned in the backyard in a foot and a half deep plastic pool. And, I've just given you a tip of the iceberg about some of my earlier history where I was the guy that got the call when brother got in a fight with eight guys with crowbars and bumper jacks and I go in. I was responsible. I'm really more worried with what you'll think about me if I don't. I'm so afraid of what you think of me that I'll put my life and yours on the line and I'll go in anyway, but I'm terrified to go do what I did. And I did that stuff. That little girl drowned and didn't die. She was in a coma for a year. After 6 weeks, they put her out of the hospital because they knew she wasn't going to get better. My then wife, who was, I believe, the child of an alcoholic father, said that was unacceptable. We'll take her home. We'll take care of her ourselves. And we brought that little girl home to live with us in that nasty little house. And she slept in a crib on my side of the bed, plugged into machines that we got from a charity. She had a trach tube in her neck. She had a feeding tube in her stomach. She was in a profound coma for a year. And she required 24-hour-a-day constant care, feeding, physical therapy, trips to the doctor, round-the-clock care. And I will tell you that when I followed her to that first AA meeting and I heard a speaker that night, I still remember the person, I remember what they talked about, and I heard the process of the steps at work, I knew there was some stuff here that I could use. There's a lot of things in my life that could help me with. I'm not sure how to get it because I'm not an alcoholic, but I'm very much attracted to what I see. But I know with an absolute certainty that piece of guilt I'm carrying that I'm about to tell you about, you can't touch with that. And that is that for the entire year that little girl lay in a coma by my side of the bed, I did virtually none of her care because I could not do it. I would stand at the foot of her crib and I'd listen to the heart machine dinging and I'd listen to her, the suction machine, which is the bane of my existence to this day, and watch her trying to expel that little piece of mucus because she's strangling on her own snot. And you're trying to catch it with a suction machine. And something would happen to me where the feelings would get right up here where they might get out. And I've got to go. I sound like a guy who's got a lot of courage. I'm racing cars and motorcycles and doing gunfights, gang fights, and car chases. And I don't have the courage to be a man and a husband and a father to my family who needed it more than anything. That's what I'm dragging. You can fix a lot of stuff, but I'm relatively certain you can't fix that. But it's what came in here with me, that piece of shame. She died after a year in a coma. And I don't want to get into it, but when I got the call, I raced to the hospital. My family had already gotten there. They brought me from work. And my dad met me in the hallway, and he says, come with me. My daughter was dead already, and I didn't know, and they all knew. My father walked me down the hallway past a room where my family was waiting. They watched me go past the door, walked me down into a door where I found my two-year-old little girl laying without a blanket on a stainless steel table to find out that she had died. And I hated my dad for that. I hated him for blindsiding me with that. I don't deal with emotions that well. What I know now, because I've been hanging around you guys around AA for a long time, is those are the things that cause the alcoholic to drink. My friends who are alcoholic, when they got to that place, would put in a drug or put in some alcohol and get out of that spot, and it never did that for me. If it did, I'd have had a tool to survive that. I'd have been drunk then, I'd be drunk now, and it never did that for me. I shared that at AA conventions. It's the scariest thing those people have ever heard in their life. What would you do on the day that you put that in and changed everything about you as an alcoholic and made it suddenly for the first time okay for you to breathe everybody else's air and to interact with another human being, and you were enough for the first time? I never had that experience. I got nothing. When I put that little girl in the ground, I remember standing at her grave and putting the dirt in, because we buried her the same day of the funeral. And I made a conscious decision that I put God in there with her, and I threw dirt on both of them, and I never went back. I got no tools to deal with what happens to me when I think about it. I don't talk to you about it. It's just that never happened. I never had a daughter. She never died. There wasn't a year in a coma. Got no tools to deal with it when it comes up. It just doesn't exist anymore. Till I got to you. Till I got to doing the work. Till I went to that female sponsor's house, dragging everything I got in an inventory. It was all written down except for that piece. I don't know how to write it. And I brought it all. And you know that jumping off place in the inventory when you're doing a fifth step where you get to this point and you wonder, if it's going good this far, I'll give them the rest. And I got to that point and I said, and here's this. And I found out I was wrong. That we got a tool for everything here. That it's not going to be the one, it's not going to be the timing you think it is, but we got a tool. And I wound up at direction of that sponsor writing an amends letter to that little girl for being an absent father, for being a cowardly dad, for not being able to be there for her. And I went back to the cemetery for the first time in 13 years. And I stood on her grave and I read that letter because it was all I had. Began to clean them little places in me that I didn't think were cleanable. And, you know, you do an amends like that, and you do it all the way, which is what I did. Do it all the way. And then you get the benefit from it and you think that's it. But if God ain't done with you, God ain't done with you, there's going to be more stuff. When we get the phone call one night, her friend Vanda that she talked about, our house didn't start more until Vanda called and she'd answer the phone. She'd say, "Morning, darling." That was how our day started every single day. Vanda got sick, she didn't have anybody, and we were kind of looking after her. One night she got what she couldn't breathe, and Leslie jumped in her car to go down and visit her. She called me up, she says, "I need to bring Vanda home." And my answer was, absolutely. We brought Vanda home. The next day we had a hospital bed delivered. We had hospice come in. We had rotating shifts of Al-Anon and AA helping take care of her and feed her and bathe her and medicate her and visit with her and chat with her. Love filled up our house. I don't remember, she was there 3 or 4 weeks before she died. And I got to do everything for Vanda that I was never, ever able to do for my daughter. Because I was no longer afraid of what was going to happen to me, that belief that when the feelings get up here and get away, that it's gone forever, I'll never get it back. Nobody said that, but it's what I believed. And there came a day when what she talked about, when her sponsee wound up on the street with 4 little girls. And to 3 little girls and a little boy. They asked me to take her to treatment. So I was going to take her down to Laguna. I said, "I'd be glad to transport her down there." Leslie had a speaking commitment out of state. I said, "But homie, don't be doing no 12-step work. I need an AA woman to go with me." And she sent her friend, her sponsee, Kit, went with me to go pick up this woman and take her to recovery. And we knocked on the door and she didn't answer. And now we're the Starsky and Hutch of AA figuring out how we're going to break in and get her. And who's going to shove who over the fence to pick the lock on the sliding door when the door flies open. And here she stands naked and wet thinking that maybe it's a bad day to go to AA. And Kim looks at me and she goes, "Oh, that's why I'm here." I said, "You dress her, I'll pack her, let's go." We got her a bottle to get her in the car. I carried her in unconscious to the recovery place. This is, as a non-alcoholic, this is the best way I know to have some kind of an understanding of the disease and some kind of compassion. I laid her on a bed in this halfway house and they began to ask her questions. This little cute little one, skinny woman came in. She goes, "I know this sounds silly and I know she's unconscious, but we just have to do it. I have to ask her these questions. How long have you been drinking? What have you had to drink? Blah, blah, blah." She's out. She asked a question, asked a question, asked a question. She got to the last question on the page and she said, "Why are you here?" Our daughter's biological mother opened her eyes, rolled her head over on the bed, and through cracked lips she said, "Because I want to get better," and passed out. I'm going to tell you now, that was a long time ago. That was 2001. I absolutely believed her. I knew that she wanted it more than anything. But as the events would eventually tell, she wasn't able to get it. She couldn't get it, want it wasn't enough. And as Leslie said, I think it was 7 years ago, she died homeless on the streets in Tennessee, one of the saddest funerals. I sent my wife and my older daughter back there to plant her. Saddest funerals they'd ever seen, because she died where alcoholism takes you, all alone. It's you and booze. And she died of it. Been hanging out with you guys for a long time. I got my second sponsor in this meeting, the infamous Kevin Dolan. Kevin was a long-timer in AA. He had 1 year less than me in Al-Anon, but he had what I wanted. He was the happiest guy I knew, and he had 9 sober brothers and sisters. I want to know how that guy did that. And I walked with Kevin for a long time, and Kevin began to travel a lot, and I started calling Willie, because you guys trained me well, man. I pick up the phone, and if he's not available, call the next number. I would call Willie. And I'll just tell you this quick thing, because my wife has told you most of the other important stuff, is that in 1999, I'd been asked to speak down the South Bay Roundup. I was the Monday morning spiritual speaker. And she's had health issues over the years, and she's had pretty serious ones. And at 4 o'clock in the morning and on the 4th of July, Sunday the 4th of July in 1999, I woke up for no good reason. I knew something was wrong. I ran to the bathroom and I found her dead on the bathroom floor. And face down in a pool of blood, naked and not breathing. I drug her out and threw her on the bed and I gave her CPR and I got her. She started breathing and choking and I'm yelling at her, "Leslie, breathe, Leslie, breathe." Call the front desk, 4 o'clock in the morning. They answered on one ring. I said, "My wife has collapsed, I need an ambulance right away." They said, "Paramedics are in the building, they're on the way." Now she's sitting up in bed. She doesn't know what happened. I don't know what happened. Her nose is broken. Her head's busted open. There's blood and vomit everywhere. She died again. This is three times. Next time's my turn. She sucks at dying. My turn next. The door flies open and six people come sailing in. Two paramedics, two house security, two front desk staff. In the door they go. Start asking her questions. What happened? What happened? What happened? She goes, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And then the paramedic says, what do you remember? She says, I remember my husband yelling at me. Oh yeah. They're about to perp walk the Al-Anon spiritual speaker out of the hotel for 3,000 people. House security steps into the hallway and I hear him cue his radio and he goes, got a domestic violence call here. I looked at the paramedics and I said, listen to me carefully. No matter what happens here, I have the best medical insurance in the world, bar none, none better. You get her, what she needs. Get her your help and we'll figure it out later. And follow her to the hospital again, following red lights and siren across the desert for the first time, and off to the South Bay Hospital in the South Bay. And we wound up going back. And I said, you want to go home? Told the committee, got to go. Can't stay here and talk. She's, you know, you saw what happened. I'm leaving. Better have a backup plan. She goes, no, I'm staying. I'm staying. As a result of staying and doing that talk that Monday morning, that was not the talk I thought I went there to make, I wound up connecting with some people who are really, really close and really intricate in our life. It was a total God weekend as a result of that. These people came into our life as a direct result of that. Our experience has been the same. Doesn't matter where we go. When you do what we do, when you're willing to be of service, and this is only one way to be of service, if you set up the chairs, do the coffee, take a GR job, stand when they're looking for a delegate or a district rep, whatever, these are the possibilities that open for you. There's no place in the world that I can go that I don't know somebody. There's no place. We travel all over the world. We went to an English-speaking AA meeting in Rome a month and a half ago. They have four people every night. We showed up with our group. There were 75 of us. They didn't know there were that many people sober in the world. They were horrified. I have family everywhere I go. But it started with you, and it mostly started with the men in this room, men who I truly love. And that I love you thing, that was for Dublin, who was the most unlovable guy I ever met when I got here. We just loved him until he couldn't stand it and had to love us back. So I close by saying, I love you, Dublin. Thank you. Yeah.